Superhuman eyes. Accelerated evolution.
Imagine a world where the foods we eat daily are quietly eroding our brain's capabilities, silently accelerating the aging process of our most vital organ. Recent groundbreaking studies have unveiled the shocking impact of ultra-processed foods on our brain health, revealing significant reductions in gray matter volume and white matter integrity. This isn't science fiction. This is our reality. As bad as this sounds, and is, the good news is we can turn this around and actively not only stop the damage to our brain, but heal it and optimize it. Our guest today is a globally recognized expert whose work has revolutionized our understanding of brain health and the critical role of diet in neurological function. We are honored to speak with Dr. David Perlmutter, a board-certified neurologist and fellow of the American College of Nutrition. He is the author of multiple New York Times best-selling books, including Grain Brain, which has sold millions of copies worldwide, and his latest, Drop Acid, which explores the surprising role of uric acid in metabolic diseases. Dr. Perlmutter's extensive research and groundbreaking findings have been published in esteemed journals such as the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, Archives of Neurology, and Neurosurgery. Dr. Perlmutter's research has been a beacon of hope, offering practical, science-backed strategies for enhancing brain health and preventing neurodegenerative diseases. Today, we will delve into how ultra-processed foods contribute to cognitive decline and brain structure changes, explore the gut-brain axis, profound impact on neurological health, and talk about innovative preventative strategies for conditions like Alzheimer's. In a world where chronic diseases and cognitive decline are on the rise, Dr. Perlmutter's insights are practical guidance and hope. Whether you're concerned about your brain health, seeking to enhance cognitive resilience, or looking for the latest scientific breakthroughs in neurology, this conversation is packed with invaluable information. Dr. Perlmutter, what a pleasure and what a privilege to be able to talk to you today. Welcome to the Superhumanized Podcast.
Ariane, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, me too, so much. And something that's stuck into my brain, and brain health is obviously something we're going to focus on today. So something that stuck in my brain was something you spoke about in another really fantastic interview, where you said that we need to activate the happy parts of our brain. We need to activate the prefrontal cortex. And you spoke about how our lifestyles often basically hinder that. Can we do a dive into this? Because I know so many people.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that the prefrontal cortex would be the happy part of the brain. I think that it is a bit distant from that level of emotionality, but it's certainly critically important for us in terms of our decision-making and making better decisions. Ultimately, I think it's going to lead to happiness and fulfillment. Where I was in that discussion is a place where we've simplified the mechanisms in the brain and the anatomy of the brain that are involved in how we decide what we're going to do. And to simplify it, we have two major areas. One is a more primitive area called the amygdala. And that is the child in the room. I want it now. I don't care what happens. Give it to me. And then as we mature, we develop more activity in the prefrontal cortex, but the area behind the forehead, that becomes the adult in the room, that allows us to take in much more information and use all that good information to make better decisions. Not just thinking about what my desires are right now, but to think about how my decisions are going to play out in the future. How will that affect me in the future? And importantly, how are my decisions going to affect other people, the planet, have wide-ranging impacts based upon the decisions that I make? So the issue is that we're not able to really tap into that adult in the room until we're at least in our mid to late teenage years. That's when a communication is established between the prefrontal cortex and the more primitive amygdala area that says, I want to do it now. And we call this connection then the influence of the prefrontal cortex. We call it top-down control. whereby the adult in the room really has control. And that is a situation we'd like to maintain for the rest of our lives. We want to make good decisions. When we threaten that connection, and I'll explain how we threaten that in just a moment, then the amygdala takes over. And it happens when adults, it doesn't matter what part of life you are in, you can become self-centered and become in a situation where you're making decisions that don't consider the future, that don't consider other people, that are really just based upon what you want for you now. And that's when the adult is taken out of the equation. And we don't think that's necessarily a good thing. The connection then that allows the adult to phone in the recommendations is something we have to maintain. And that connection is threatened by a mechanism called inflammation. Whenever we are in situations that increase inflammation in the body, then our decision-making is threatened. In other words, if we don't get enough good restorative sleep and inflammation's increased, we make worse decisions the very next day. When we are eating diets that are pro-inflammatory, high in ultra-processed foods and sugars, etc., we make worse decisions. And what do? Then we eat those foods again and again, further keeping us away from having the adult help us make our decisions. It's an explanation, I think, that explains what we're seeing in the world today, where decision-making is not ideal. Let's leave it at that. And we can consider all of the factors that might be at play here in terms of why so many areas of the brain, are, of the globe rather, are having such issues. But one thing is to consider that what we used to call the standard American diet became the Western diet and is now the global diet. And this is a diet that's really of poor quality, that is favoring these processed foods, that's increasing blood sugar and dramatically increasing inflammation. And as such, globally, this shift in nutrition is keeping us from having the influence of the adult in the room and locking us into being much more self-centered and really lacking concern for other people. So I'm not sure that's the answer you were looking for, but it sure takes this neurophysiology to a new level of understanding the relationship of human behavior to the global changes that we've seen in global nutrition.
Yes, this answer resonates so much with me, Dr. Perlmutter, and it is at the core of my own mission and ethos, also at the core of our company, different companies' missions in health and wellness. I firmly believe that when individuals can get more centered, can get out of this fight or flight mode, whether it's by nutrition, positive lifestyle enhancements or changes, whether it's supplementation, we not only make better decisions for ourselves, we make better decisions for our families, we make better decisions for the human family as a whole, we make better decisions for this beautiful planet that we are so fortunate to be part of and to live on and off. And so this is, yeah, this is so resonates so deeply at the core of my being. And I also firmly believe if in an ideal world, we were, for example, all sleeping well, moving adequately and eating, really great nutritious whole foods diet, we would not see a lot of this strife and against each other and
no question
political extremism and hating on another in the world.
Yeah, and this isn't pointing a finger at anything but my thesis of diet playing a role. So I think we're on good ground here, not threatening anybody. We're looking at this from a nutritional perspective and also mechanistic perspective in terms of taking a step back and recognizing that this mechanism of inflammation is threatening to the brain. A study that appeared in the journal Neurology back in 2017 was a study that was actually begun about 29 years before. They took a group of people, they measured the size of their brains with imaging studies, and they did a blood test to determine what was the level of inflammation in their bodies. They followed these people, 1,600 people, for 26 years. And what they found when they finally stopped the study 26 years later was that those individuals at the beginning of the test who had larger amounts of inflammation in their blood had much smaller brains. It's an indication that having a small brain is not a good thing. And if you want to preserve your brain and have it not shrink, then you've got to do everything you can to reduce inflammation, the production of inflammation in your body. And that focuses on the foods that you eat, the exercise you get, and the quality and quantity of your sleep. Those are the big three pillars.
Yes.
And it's tough to get that messaging across, because the messaging that I think that we receive, at least in the developed world, is one of kind of live your life however you want, do whatever mm-hmm. you want, and then there'll be a drug to fix your problem. We don't have a drug that's going to help your shrunken brain, or certainly we don't have any drug that's going to fix your Alzheimer's disease as yet. If there were a drug, I would welcome it. So we really have to be involved in what the word doctor means. And it means teacher. It doesn't mean healer. It doesn't mean pick up the pieces and help somebody put it together again. It means healer. And prevention is a huge part of that. It means teacher, ultimately. And that's the mission, is to give people the tools such that they can make the right choices. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that happen. We're seeing, do what you want, we'll fix it. And that's so unfair to people, because we know why people are getting into trouble. We know that 58% of the calories consumed by American adults come from ultra-processed foods. And we clearly understand the relationship between the consumption of ultra-processed foods and risk for Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and even forms of cancer. And yet, nobody's talking about that, because getting that word out is not something that can be monetized. But watch the television and the evening news, and all you will see are advertisers for drugs for autoimmune conditions and other issues that can very well be prevented if we get the word out about how important lifestyle changes are.
100%, Dr. Perlmutter. And speaking about the news, that's another thing that, when just mindlessly, habitually consumed, will have an effect on our all over health, and then will exacerbate other conditions, then making us, in our distress, reaching for those drugs that are advertised on the same news. And this study you spoke about in neurology, I believe that's the one where they also very clearly showed how these ultra-processed foods have such a terrible impact on cognitive function, brain structure, and the reduction in the gray matter that you spoke about, as well as white matter integrity. So this is really a huge attack, a huge burden on the brain. I just the other day came across something on social media where a gentleman underwent actually a self-test, and he went from a diet that he considered pretty healthy, 80% healthy foods, 20% ultra processed foods. So he went to 80% UPFs. And within 4 weeks, the brain scans showed change.
Yeah.
Negative change. 4 weeks.
And that was what we call a volumetric. You know, that's a volumetric analysis. But we're now able, and I don't mean to get too technical here, but the threat of these ultra processed foods and the creation of inflammation is that the mediators, the signaling molecules of inflammation, change the brain's immune cells called microglial cells, and then puts them into a situation where they've gone from being a friend to being foe. They've gone to being from angel to being assassin, and they're destroying neurons and synapses and increasing the production of beta amyloid. And that is, again, because of their exposure to these inflammatory chemicals brought on by the very diet that you just described, this ultra-processed foods diet. And getting back to your report of this individual showing brain shrinkage, we can actually scan the brain now to determine the change in those immune cells, the activation of those immune cells instantaneously in living people. Wow, it's amazing technology, but wow, that's going to really open the door to some incredible interventions. Our mission is to reprogram those microglial cells back to being friendly, back to being supportive of our brains, as opposed to being threatening. That's the big mission.
So I have a question for you. Obviously, to you and I, and also the audience is very well educated, and people, as far as I can also tell via messages that reach us via social media and other channels, really well on their way on this optimizing health journey, on this preventative journey to living long really well. So food, diet, the diet, sleep, movement, etc., is crucial. These are the pillars. When you speak about what you just mentioned, so what can actually be done, maybe now, maybe in the foreseeable future, at a molecular level to mitigate these terrible effects?
We know that the lifestyle changes. The reason I took a big breath there is when you hear where we're going with this, it's going to, I think, surprise you. But we know that instituting the lifestyle changes right now will go a long way to reestablishing brain health and offsetting this inflammation, et cetera. That's the foundation of so many lifestyle intervention programs that are having good results as it relates to preserving brain volume, preserving and, in fact, actually increasing the volume of the memory center called the hippocampus. And after 1 year, at least in one study from the University of Pittsburgh, actually showing improvement of cognitive function. But where we're going, I think that's the question, is I'm going to say it, GLP-1 agonists, drugs like Ozempic. I will embrace anything as long as we are satisfied with the risk and benefit ratio. Studies as it relates to actual Alzheimer's treatment are currently either in planning stages or early stages of being implemented. There are at least three studies there that are being done. Perhaps the biggest is called the ELAD study. There's another study called the EVOKE study, and another one that's actually using a drug like Ozempic, but orally, I think 14 milligrams a day of semaglutide and following cognitive function. And my sense is they're going to hit the ball out of the park. Why do I say that? I say that because 6 weeks ago in the New England Journal of Medicine was a published report in which they used these a GLP-1 type drug, an Ozempic type drug, in a 3-year study of Parkinson's patients. And what did they find? Parkinson's is a disease that generally we assume is going to get worse with time. And we don't have any medications to treat Parkinson's at all, as in zero. What I mean by that is we do have drugs that treat the tremor. We do have drugs that treat the rigidity and the constipation, all those things. But the actual treatment of the underlying fire, not just paying attention to the smoke, the actual treatment of the disease itself has never happened, except we did some work with intravenous glutathione. We know that hyperbaric oxygen targets the mitochondria, can be helpful. But this study in the New England Journal of Medicine, arguably the most well-respected journal on the planet, followed people for 3 years, placebo versus intervention. And in the people receiving this Ozempic-like drug, their Parkinson's disease was completely arrested. They had no further decline in function.
Well,
It's breathtaking.
Dr. Perlmutter, and this really hits close to home. I'm getting a little choked up. My father has been diagnosed with Parkinson's over 15 years ago. He's still pretty much sharp as a tack, as he always used to be cognitively. However, physically, the disease has taken its toll. So I'm also very familiar about with the medications that can mitigate certain symptoms like the tremors, etc. So I'm really curious, where does this stand right now? This is a study.
This was a study. No one's going to say, therefore, you should all be jumping on Ozempic. The GLP-1 drug that they actually used was a smaller molecule than Ozempic. And they chose that because they felt it'd be more likely to be able to cross into the brain, cross the blood-brain barrier. I will tell you that more than 40% of the people on the actual drug had issues with nausea, vomiting, et cetera. So it wasn't very well tolerated. So I think the issue here is to sharpen the pencils a little bit and develop a GLP-1 agonist drug that will cross the blood-brain barrier and not have such a significant adverse response profile as this drug did. But by all means, this was New England Journal of Medicine. In fact, I posted a video blog on it that probably is live at this time, which has the reference. We walked through it. And I think one tangential note I would make, and I think I made it already, but I'll reiterate, is that Dr. Perlmutter is not against drugs. I want everything in my toolbox that will help. Whatever can help your father, I'm going to reach for, provided we do the math on risk and benefit. And we all work through it together, not just me, but patients and families. We accept risk or we don't. And But I think that with your dad and his situation, you've got a lot to be hopeful about now that we understand this physiology and biochemistry that's involved in this GLP-1 pathway. So, what can you do right now? Is your dad diabetic by chance?
No, he's not.
Not type 2 diabetic or pre-diabetic? Not to.
Not
All
as
right.
far as I know, no.
Okay. What are some of the things that you can do right now to increase GLP-1 activity in the brain? There are a couple. One of them is a probiotic called Akkermansia. You've probably heard of that, Akkermansia muciniphila. And the next would be to use something called allulose. Allulose is a type of sweetener that's become very popular that actually and really quite dramatically increases GLP-1 release from the L cells in the small intestine. So those are things that you should discuss with your father's treating physician. But there's great reason, I think, to be optimistic. And I'm going to extend that optimism beyond Parkinson's to Alzheimer's as well. Because what we're doing or what is being done when you use a drug that targets the GLP-1 receptors, the drugs like Ozempic and Mounjaro, et cetera, is you are changing the metabolism of the very cells I talked about earlier in the brain, the immune cells called microglia. You're actually improving their metabolism and, as such, reverting them back to being the helpful, nice twin as opposed to the evil twin. We talked about that, how you can image them and et cetera. That's what you're doing with this type of intervention, increasing GLP-1. I think there's great reason for optimism. And you know what? If it's coming from a pharmaceutical intervention, I'm all in.
I'm right there with you, Dr. Perlmutter, and thank you for these really great insights, especially the allulose. I know my father has always had a sweet tooth, so if he can drink sweet tea and sweet coffee, he's very happy.
Sweeten
So
it with allulose.
I'll pass on that information ASAP, as well as the Akkermansia. Talking about inflammation, especially this chronic low-grade inflammation, which has been linked to, as you mentioned, various neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So UPFs are a big source, a huge source of the neuroinflammation in our diet. And what else is neuroinflammation caused by our diet? But so how about other things that people may not be aware of that they're surrounded with every day? Are there other things one ought to be really careful with and aware
Well, I
of?
think that the question that you're asking is what are then, if we believe that inflammation is playing the central role, and I can't imagine these days anyone would argue that point, that we ask ourselves, then what are the things that are augmenting or increasing inflammation? And do you see any association with Alzheimer's? One of the common things that elevates inflammation in the human body is blood sugar elevation. So if you're able to measure your blood sugar, that's a surrogate marker for inflammation in the human body. And we know that studies that date back to 2013, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, looked at a group of 1,600 individuals, followed them for 6.7 years, and did neurocognitive testing at the beginning of the examination of the study and after 6.7 years. And the only test they did at the beginning of the test was a fasting blood sugar. End of story. And what they found after, let's say, 7 years was that those individuals with the higher blood sugars had a decline in cognitive function in relation to the elevation of their blood sugar. But interestingly, that even subtle elevations of blood sugar were associated with cognitive decline. And these are blood sugars at around 105. Where normally you get a blood sugar 105, your doctor's going to give you a pat on the back and say, okay, we'll see you next year. So the idea of having your blood sugar in the normal range, I think, is silly, to be fair. I think we should be telling people what is optimal, not normal. What is, because normal these days is not real good. So we need to keep our blood sugars a lot lower, like 80, at most 90. And it's not good enough to have a blood sugar test once a year and hope for the best. There's a lot of value in having what's called a continuous glucose monitor and knowing much more information, the dynamics of your blood sugar controls. The second thing, then, that in addition to the ultra processed foods is elevation of blood sugar, which actually is one of the consequences of the ultra processed foods in the first place. The other thing that ultra processed foods can do, as can many other things do, is increase the leakiness or permeability of the gut lining by virtue of changing the milieu of and function of the gut bacteria. So that's a big threat. We don't want the gut to become more permeable, or in common parlance, leaky, because when things get through the gut lining that shouldn't, guess what it does? It amplifies inflammation in the body. And that's the reason that we can correlate then changes in the gut microbiome to things like cardiovascular disease, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, various forms of autoimmune conditions, various forms of cancer, certainly type 2 diabetes and obesity, correlate with these changes that we see in the not just the array and diversity of the gut bacteria, but their function as well. We talked about one bacterium earlier called Akkermansia mucinophila. And across the spectrum of the diseases I just described are seen lower levels of Akkermansia. One of the key things that Akkermansia does is keeps that gut lining intact, keeps it where it needs to be. As well, as I mentioned earlier, leads to the production of chemicals that stimulate formation of GLP-1. Wowzers, that's a cool thing. Anything that is going to threaten the gut bacteria, like various medications, non-steroid anti-inflammatory drugs, acid-blocking drugs, and certainly antibiotics, a powerful threat, weapons of mass microbial destruction. Not that there's not a need for them at times, there certainly is. But I think the data would indicate that our usage of antibiotics is grossly overblown in Western countries. You go to the doctor with a sniffle and you walk out with a Z-Pak or something. And that's just, to me, not generally in most people making a lot of sense. I guess I'll go on record as having said that. Pardon me?
Yes. I agree with you 100%, Dr. Perlmutter. Just yesterday, I had a lady walk in at our clinic. We have a health and wellness clinic here in Santa Monica, and she had some pain that was not determined yet what the cause was. Her doctor sounded like a well-meaning person. However, the doctor just randomly prescribed her some very strong antibiotics, a course of 7 days that she was supposed to take without even having a diagnosis, just on the
suspicion
that
I
it may
love
be.
That.
And I was just thinking, oh my gosh. And this, so yeah, I hear things like that all the time.
Yeah, I don't generally, there are certain lines I won't cross, but I think that the data that we're grossly overusing antibiotics, especially in the pediatric population, that's pretty clear. The American Medical Association has really called upon practicing physicians to be much more careful about their usage and overprescription of antibiotics, because it's not without consequence. Everybody is worried if you take antibiotics, you might get C. difficile, and that's a big deal. But what is that? That's actually the overgrowth of one bacterial species, which causes significant illness, because you've changed the microbiome. You've changed the parameters within the gut. You've taken away some of the bacteria species that were keeping C. difficile in check. And how do you treat C. diff? More antibiotics. That makes a lot of sense. But the effectiveness, I'm going on a tangent here, but I'm going to finish the thought. The effectiveness of antibiotics to treat C. diff is about 28%. The effectiveness of a fecal microbial transplant to treat C. diff is around 85 to 90% by putting back the good bugs in the gut. Your viewers can do with that what they choose. Not that that's a very common situation. The point I'm trying to make here is that we've got to care for our gut bacteria. If you want to have a healthy brain, which is why you and I are together today, it starts in the gut. People talk about the gut-brain connection. To be fair, the brain-gut connection as well. It's bidirectional. And things that go on in the gut are highly influential in terms of the brain's risk for disease, as well as its moment-to-moment function. And it extends well beyond cognitive function. It extends to mood as well, like anxiety and depression and things like PTSD, et cetera.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And you talk extensively about this also in your book, Brain Maker. And I think people are waking up much more so now than they were aware of 5 years ago, to this connection and what they can do, and not just focusing on your physical shape and being fit and being able to optimize your body, but to really take good care of your brain. Something that's a little bit sideways, but I'm curious to hear your take on it, Dr. Perlmutter, in case you're aware of it. There is a plant medicine that is named as Iboga. One of the main active compounds is called ibogaine. And there is a Dr. Nolan from Stanford. Him and his colleagues have done quite some extensive research on this compound and have found that at every turn, they found, my goodness, it's good for this, it's good for this, it's good for this. And coincidentally, when they did a brain scan of an individual who had partaken in one session of ibogaine that was administered to them, the volume of the brain matter increased, and they had never come across anything like that before. I believe the findings were also studied in Nature, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. And so ibogaine was originally explored and studied about 2.5 decades ago, or 2 decades ago, by researchers at the University of Miami, and did find some clinical application for addiction, even for alcoholism, and was shown to be, as you mentioned, one dosage, shown to be quite effective. And I think the notion that ibogaine stimulates neurogenesis is, as has been demonstrated, falls in line with the effect on both the genesis of new neurons, i.e., therefore changes in the brain, and synaptogenesis, the increased production of connections one neuron to the next, we've seen with other hallucinogens, and we've certainly seen with other natural plant products like lion's mane mushroom, for example. This is getting a lot of attention with good reason. And one small study has actually demonstrated in Japan, small group, I think 7 individuals, improved cognitive function and increased neurogenesis in individuals who were given lion's mane mushroom. So this whole notion that these hallucinogens, including ibogaine, ayahuasca, psilocybin, can increase neurogenesis and what we call synaptic plasticity, I think is well documented, and certainly documented in laboratory animals, and may well have a role to play in their effectiveness in terms of treating neuropsychiatric issues. We've understood for quite some time, first in the laboratory animal and now extrapolated to humans, that the effectiveness of the so-called SSRI drugs, serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, like originally Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, et cetera, we thought the development of these drugs was based upon the idea that serotonin is the happy chemical. Mm-hmm. If we can get rid of the enzyme or knock it down that gets rid of serotonin, there'll be more serotonin and people will be happier. So that's how the drugs had their development. But it turns out that the effectiveness of SSRI antidepressants depends upon their ability to make something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That's the factor that leads to growth of new brain cells, neurogenesis, and synaptogenesis. And in fact, the effectiveness of SSRIs, at least in the rodent model, is dependent upon the turning on of this BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. To me, there's this interesting relationship then that we're seeing between growth of new brain cells, increasing synapse formation, and therapeutic benefit. And I think maybe that's a long-winded response to your ibogaine question, but we are just at the very beginning of this exploration. And I think for so many people suffering with neuropsychiatric issues, there's great hope. And the fact that there's research around the country being done now on hallucinogens to treat people with challenging neuropsychiatric issues, suicidal ideation, et cetera, I think is so welcome that we've gotten away from this notion that these are bad drugs to be condemned, and yet they have such terrific therapeutic potential. So I really support the research that's being done.
I love hearing that from you, Dr. Perlmutter. I personally have had the privilege to meet with a lot of individuals who have been suffering with pretty severe issues they've been battling, whether it's severe PTSD, a lot of veterans, trauma, deep trauma, stress, individuals with suicidal ideation. And for example, at our clinic, we offer ketamine IV therapy in conjunction with work with therapists. And that alone has literally been life-changing for hundreds and hundreds of people who've come through our doors, and also sustainably.
And with very minimal amounts of intervention in terms of time. Really, when people were facing years of psychotherapy and multiple drug interventions, now the speed at which they can improve is breathtaking. It's absolutely breathtaking. And sadly, these drugs were put on a shelf under lock and key for so long. But it's okay. And we'll move forward and be grateful that we can have access to them now.
Absolutely. And I think we're looking at the rescheduling of MDMA this August, which is another of these medicines, which I consider them to be, and especially when importantly so, they're administered in a clinical setting where it's really tailor-made to the individual's needs and it's monitored, it's safe. It's the highest grade of whatever compound you're using. While they are not a silver bullet for everyone, for so many, they're not only an alternative, but they can not only be life-changing, but life-saving. Speaking about suicidal ideation, which you just mentioned, some of these medicines can basically take people right out of these thought loops, which you cannot, even if you so desire, oh, I need to stop thinking that way. You cannot.
No, you're right.
Yes. So but it's.
I will say there was one word that you used, and it was monitored. I think that's really very fundamental that in a therapeutic way, that the use of these approaches needs to be conducted with professionals who know what they're doing and how to treat people and how to guide them through their experiences, which may not always be pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very true. A lot of things can come up that have been repressed.
Oh, and they will.
As a coping mechanism, as a survival mechanism. And so it is absolutely crucial that one is in very good hands medically and also as far as therapy goes, to have that support, and not only during the experience, but after the experience for integration. And a really interesting quote, side effect, a positive side effect, in my opinion, is from a lot of these treatments, the neuroplasticity, the state of neuroplasticity that for a certain period of time is given is enhanced. Now, not everybody wants to, nor should they, let's say, do ketamine IV treatment or seek out legislations where iboga, ibogaine is legal, or ayahuasca or such. These are not necessarily medicines for everyone. So talking about other ways of increasing neuroplasticity, which is also crucial for cognitive resilience, I believe there are certain dietary components that have also shown to enhance this. Are there any specific nutrients or dietary patterns that you've observed that have the potential to, or actually have, a most significant impact on promoting neuroplasticity?
And there is, and it's a diet that's called exercise. So this is the surefire, rapid way to augment your BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is to engage in physical exercise instantly. So this is one of the things that happens, one of the things that, you know, using your muscles will help increase. And it's free. You got to buy a pair of running shoes or whatever exercise you're going to get. In the supplement world, we know that DHA and omega-3, mm-hmm. fit from fish oil or algae or vegetarian derived, however you want to get it, is pretty potent also in increasing BDNF. There's whole coffee fruit extract as well that will increase BDNF. And there has been some suggestion that being on a ketogenic diet can do it as well. But by far and away, exercise is the key to make that happen, and therefore really helps to tie up in a neat package, this relationship between exercise and preservation of cognitive function, as well as augmentation of cognitive function. It's through this mechanism of, you know, turning on brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Mm-hmm. Outstanding. And I love that. I'm a big fan. I try to get a move on at least 5 times a week. And when I don't, when I miss this for whatever reason, 2 weeks, if I'm extremely, quote, busy and don't make time for it, I notice an effect. I notice a reduction in focus. I notice a reduction in cognitive output. And even in the short term, it has such a huge impact. Dr. Perlmutter, I'd like to circle back on purpose, knowing how human wired. So we talked about the microbiome and the brain gut axis, the gut brain connection. You said it goes two ways. And obviously, we want people to take care of their brains. Now, sometimes certain other things make people perk up a little more and listen a little more intensely. You actually recently had a blog post about this, and also recent research from UCLA has indicated the significant role of the semen microbiome in male fertility. And I believe a bacteria that was especially highlighted was Lactobacillus innermus. Could you illuminate for us how the semen microbiome influences sperm quality and fertility?
Let me just take a step back and just embrace the notion that there is even a microbiome in the semen, that there is a microbiome in the brain, in the mouth, on the skin, in the gut. We get that. But that there's within, in the placenta, for crying out loud, is a microbiome, that we live in this relationship with microbes to the extent to which we've never embraced. And the post that I put out indicated that the ability of semen to do its job is affected by the array and functionality of its microbiome. It's just, to me, it's breathtaking that we're now seeing these relationships. When you mentioned a book I wrote years ago called Brain Maker. I wrote a book about the fact that the organisms in the gut influence the function of your brain. Wow. People, you should see some of the Amazon comments on that. That was probably a decade ago. People are shaking their heads saying, what does Perlmutter come up with this time? And it makes us humble. We need to be humble to embrace that every aspect of our functionality, including the ability to fertilize an egg with our sperm, is influenced by organisms, by microorganisms, bacteria, funguses, and viruses, all of which we tend to think about negatively, but by and large, almost all of which are here to help us. That's a different perspective. And I wrote that blog really with that in mind, that these organisms are everywhere, and we're just beginning to understand that. When you take an antibiotic, generally, it is able to permeate all of the tissues in your body to varying degrees. There are certain antibiotics that won't get into the brain very well, a certain that won't get into the synovial fluid in your joint, for example, if you have an infected joint. But pretty much in every area that I mentioned are going to be a resident microbiome that is playing a role in our health and our ability to remain healthy. That was the main reason I wrote that article.
Yes, and I really enjoyed the article. I also thought it was so smart to point that out. I know it's getting a lot of eyeballs because people are fascinated not only by microbiomes per se, but how it literally is everywhere. And same goes, of course, you mentioned it for the uterus, same goes for the vagina. I know so many women who are dealing with imbalances and issues, and the connection also between the gut microbiome, the vaginal microbiome, the connection between what you eat, if you take antibiotics or such. People are just starting to connect all these dots. And I'm curious, you are right at the pulse of this. What implications do these realizations have for the broader microbiome research and human health?
I mean, you mentioned vaginal microbiome, and I want to spend just a moment there because the birth canal is a place of transmission. We talk about vertical transmission of genetic information, meaning from parents to child, right? Comes down from one generation to the next. But horizontal transmission of genetic information happens when we transfer bacteria from one individual to the next. Well, that horizontal transmission, that's what happens when we're born. Yes. When a baby passes through the birth canal, the vaginal birth canal, there is a huge array of bacterial constituents there that anoint the newborn, that pass into the nose, into the mouth, into the eyes. These are the seeds for that infant's gut microbiome. And in the situation of a cesarean section, that process doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
The child, newborn, is going to be anointed with bacteria that are in the operating room or on the surgeon's gloves or gown in a situation in which mother has already just received a whopping dosage of intravenous antibiotics. So it explains to me why there's this strong relationship between being born by cesarean section and dramatic increased risk for autoimmune conditions like type 1 diabetes and celiac disease, and even things like autism. And these are likely a consequence of the changes that are observable in the child's gut microbiome as a consequence of being born in that way. I'm not saying that women shouldn't have C-sections, but I am saying that they're overdone in America, that's for sure. There's a time and a place, but I think that the rules get bent an awful lot, dare I say, for cosmetic and or convenience, cosmetic reasons or convenience reasons, and it's reality. A third of births in America is done by C-section. That's a lot of C-sections. And again, women receive a blast of IV antibiotics when they're having this procedure. That's standard procedure. And so I think as we get smarter about this moving forward, we'll realize that A, we need to do everything we can to deliver vaginally, and B, we need to be far more judicious overall in general with the use of antibiotics.
Yes, absolutely, Dr. Perlmutter. And what you said, I've witnessed it in my own circle of friends. Certainly, C-sections have their place and time. There are indications where it's absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
However, I have witnessed in my own circle of friends and acquaintances oftentimes that C-sections were chosen because of convenience and also for cosmetic reasons. A lot of times also, to an extent, it's also understandable and biological freedom. You get to choose what you want to do with your own body. In this case,
right.
It's going to have an impact on your baby, obviously.
But you need to know, it's to be fair, you should know the risks and benefits.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I think if an obstetrician were to say to a woman, well, the risk, you're going to have a scar, there could be an infection, whatever. But to say that you will likely double your child's risk for celiac disease or type 1 diabetes, that's profound. That is,
it is
profound. And I think if you do that, which is published statistics, there may be a significantly reduced number of women who realize versus convenience that they don't want to take that risk.
I agree. Yes. And especially if it is for cosmetic purposes or being able to jump back quicker into a job where you're, let's say, modeling or acting.
Whatever the reason may be. But I think let's talk about all of the downsides beyond just the scar and the pain and whatever else they may be told.
Yes, I'm with you.
Surgery is risky. But what about the risk of the IV antibiotic? But I think here you've done your best for all these months to create this beautiful new being, and now you're going to threaten that child by having him or her born by C-section unless it's necessary. If it's necessary, I'm in. Go for it. You got to do it for whatever reason that they think it is mandated, you do it. And there is a researcher at NYU who is exploring the idea of, prior to the C-section, putting a moistened gauze sponge in the birth canal and then having a C-section, and then afterwards taking that moistened sponge and then putting it over the child's face and into the nose, et cetera, to give that child the bacteria that he or she would have had if they would have had a vaginal birth.
Yes, and it perplexes me, Dr. Perlmutter, that has not been done yet. And it perplexes me that women are not given the information, because obviously most women who plan for convenience or even cosmetic reasons, they're just not aware of the risks and the downside for the babies. I think that's a huge failure from the side of the medical practices, hospitals, or is the awareness just not there yet? I do not want to say, oh, these people.
There are reasons that women are, that having a C-section is pretty darn easy. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for them. There are reasons that happens, but I'll let people think about what those reasons may be.
I hear you, Dr. Perlmutter. I do. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I'm so glad we were able to connect. And with a individual like such as yourself, you're so accomplished in this field of work. You have had multiple internationally best-selling books. I mentioned them in the introduction, and the work that you continue to do. As a closing question, what are you most excited about in your field of work that you're already hearing talks about or maybe witnessing that the public, general public, may not become aware of until maybe 2, 3, 4 years from now?
And the answer to this question is a unified theory of brain degeneration. There are all kinds of theories. Is Alzheimer's because of insulin resistance or vascular disease or the accumulation of beta amyloid or phosphorylated tau? What is going on here? And everybody is siloed in looking at each of these ideas. What we're seeing now is that one theory can actually explain all of these components. And the theory is something we've talked about today, and that is that there are these cells in the brain that make up 10 to 15% of the brain cells called microglia, that are the linchpin here. And that not only are the reason that this pathology arises, but are the target then that we can leverage moving forward to allow people to improve. I just said it. Yes, improve, not just stabilize with respect to Alzheimer's, but actually improve. That's what is most exciting for me. There are two research projects I'm involved in right now that are front and center involved in that, with that paradigm being the linchpin or underpinning them. So that's what's most exciting for me in my academic life.
Incredible. And that will give hope to so many people. Dr. Perlmutter, again, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It oh, my was pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed our time together.
For those of you who want to do a deeper dive and start optimizing mentally, physically, and spiritually, head over to my newsletter, to superhumanize.com/newsletter, and sign up.
Superhumanize. Accelerated evolution.